This is an interview with Margaret Murray on San Juan Island on April 24th, 19... Marty, for half a century or more, you've been involved in the preservation of American wilderness, and that presupposes a pretty heavy commitment that came from someplace. How did your own relationship to wilderness become formed, and why did that become an important part of your life?
Partly, I suppose, because I grew up in Fairbanks, Alaska. Our house was the last house on the last street in Fairbanks, not very far from the Chena River. There were little sloughs, there were ponds, there was birch forests, and I used to wander around out there. I didn't know exactly why, except that I enjoyed being out there. My stepfather said, oh, that's the gypsy in her. But really, it was Olus who introduced me to all the riches of the... I had been just wandering ignorantly in these places, and after I started traveling around with him after our marriage and on our honeymoon up in the Keokuk country, he was opening my eyes and my mind to myriad things all the time, every day. I don't know whether either one of us at that time were thinking of wilderness as something that was jeopardized or threatened. I don't think that began to happen to very many people until, well, John Muir, of course, perhaps would be one of the first ones in this country. But I don't think it touched very many people until maybe the 20s. And then came Bob Marshall with his trip to Alaska and his getting very much concerned about wilderness everywhere and working with the Forest Service and with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, realizing that areas of wilderness needed to be saved. By that time, Olus was doing this life history study of the elk in Jackson Hole. Bob Marshall came to visit us there, and that's my first recollection of people being concerned about saving great tracts of wilderness. I don't know, the Teton Wilderness in Jackson Hole in what is now Bridger-Teton National Forest, maybe one of the early, of course, the Gila Wilderness in New Mexico was the first one, and that was because of Aldo Leopold's activities. And then Art Carhart, who was working with the Forest Service out of Denver, and his suggestion that Trapper's Lake be kept as a wilderness instead of being turned into summer home sites, those are the beginnings. And as I look back on it now, I think there were isolated individual people who had these ideas and who were trying to do something all by themselves. And it was a while before conservation organizations as such either came into being or became conscious of all that they should be thinking about and doing.
That was a time of tremendous exploitation in this country, too, in the 20s, 30s. It was a time when there was a lot of land being decimated. Was that part of the impetus behind the growing idea of wilderness?
Yes, very definitely. In the case of the Quetico Superior country, the border lakes, canoe country, the timber interests were just going through there with a great sweep with all sorts of power and all sorts of ambition and greed, might say. And that's another thing about isolated individuals. There was Ernest Oberholzer, and then there was Sig Olson, and just a few other people, Frederick Winston, trying to stop the lumber companies from taking all of that country and building dams in it to make it easy for them to get their timber out and all kinds of things. Ernest Oberholzer had, you know, he started out in our Foreign Service. He was stationed in Hamburg, Germany, after he graduated from Harvard. He had a heart condition of something, and the doctors told him he probably didn't have too many years to live, so that he should take it very easy. So he came out to... His home was in Davenport, Iowa. He came out to the Rainy Lake country, and then he got acquainted with the Indians. And the next thing he did was to go on that big expedition up in Hudson Bay with just that one Indian, Billy McGee, he called him. Well, that's the way he took it easy on this tremendous canoe trip. But then he became concerned with what was happening all around him there. And so he and Sig and just a few were working on this. And maybe they held the line until more people could become involved. And I think that went on in various parts of the country with various areas, just one or two people trying to hold something.
Yeah, it was a time at which the American dream really had hold of a lot of people, of expansion, exploitation, economics, and the economic values of wilderness have always been pretty hard to sell in public. What do you think was the motivation behind the success that those men had?
I think they were able to see into the future, seeing things that were already happening and seeing what might be the outcome of those developments. And in their minds, those would be tragedies, and they were just trying to hold what they could and trying to awaken people. In 1946, when our older son came back from the Second World War, the whole family, we put our old town canoe on top of the old station wagon and drove to Rainy Lake, to the canoe country, to Ely. We went on a two-week canoe trip, and when we came back, we met Sig Olson and Elizabeth and young Sig. Olson and Sig made a flight over that country that day by airplane with the forest supervisor, and when they came back that evening, we had dinner at the Olsons. I said to Sig, "Well, what are you going to do about it?" And he looked at me and he said, "Olus and I are going to write and write and write." And they did. And then came, as I say, Bob Marshall with the idea of wilderness. And of course, I think nearly everybody knows how the Wilderness Society got started.
I don't think everybody does. Why don't you explain that a bit for us?
Bob Marshall, Harvey Broom, Benton Mackay, and Bernie Frank, and Harold Anderson had been on a backpacking trip in the Great Smoky Mountains. And on the last day, they sat down beside the trail to rest for a while, and they got to talking. And right then, they agreed that there should be some organization that was just for wilderness. And that was the idea, and that was the beginning. And Bob Marshall happened to be someone who had time, money, and energy enough to get it started. So he founded the Wilderness Society in 1935. Well, that's just an example of how things start from small beginnings. Three or four people sitting around a table or in front of somebody's fireplace or out on the trail somewhere getting concerned about something and thinking that they not only needed to write, but they needed to do.
I'm thinking of another campfire a few years earlier in Yellowstone Park that led to the creation of the National Park Service, something like that.
That's right, a few people around a campfire in 1872. And that was the beginning of the whole national park idea for the whole world. That's one thing the United States can be proud of forever, I think.
Creating the idea of national park.
I think so. Don't you?
Yeah, it's been exported, and national parks exist in almost all the major countries and the developing nations as well now. And it's one of our major contributions to humanity, isn't it? Maybe it'll be remembered long after our technology's been forgotten.
Of course, my difficulty right now is feeling that every scrap of wilderness we have left now in 1982 should be kept, saved, because even with all that, I don't think it's going to be enough for the burgeoning population. And our grandchildren and great-grandchildren, I think, are likely to be saying, why didn't they save more? And so we're still trying to pick up the pieces around.
On balance, how do you feel we're doing?
I think we're doing sort of half well, maybe. Yeah. Some things we're succeeding with, some things we're just holding the line. Right now we're just trying to hold the line. Yeah, and that's a very difficult thing right now. But looking back over the beginnings of things, I guess my first realization was the importance of all the conservation organizations working together was in that Echo Park controversy. And that began in 1950. Olus and I were at a North American Wildlife Conference in San Francisco, and the night of the last day, he said, "I can't come up to the room just yet because Newton Drury has asked a few of us to meet with him." Newton Drury was then director of the Park Service, and he said, "We're in trouble, and we need help from all of you." He had the leaders of the various groups. That was the beginning of the Echo Park battle.
Echo Park turned out, in the end, to be a real watershed for the conservation issue, didn't it?
Yes. I look back on it as a real watershed, because I think from then that time on, the conservation groups have realized that, as Olus used to say, it's going to take all of us to do it. And they realized that they needed to cooperate with one another to the very greatest extent. We never would have gotten the Alaska D2 lands bill through without that kind of a coalition. And measured against the whole population of the United States, the conservation movement doesn't have that many people in it. So they need to be forceful people.
Well, that's just it. It's never been a movement that has been able to exercise power. How do you see it having... Why has it been as effective as it has? Why has it worked as well as it has in a land where power seems to mean everything in the political scene?
Now you reminded me of something. The first year Oldys was director of the Wilderness Society, 1946. Yes. One of the first battles was over San Gorgonio in California, where they wanted to put a development. And Oldys had to start off, and it was in the wintertime, and he had to drive out from our ranch to Moose, Wyoming, and then catch a stage and go to Rock Springs and catch a train and so forth. But I remember when he said goodbye to me that morning, I said to him, "Remember, my strength is at the strength of 10 because my heart is pure." And I feel that, like Sir Galahad, some of the conservationists became so earnest and felt so deeply about these things that they were willing to stand. I always say nearly what we have going for us is stubbornness and perseverance. And perseverance on the part of a few people can awaken up some more people, and gradually they become a force. And I think that force is getting noticeably stronger now, and it's almost well organized. Now we've learned how to watch things happening, how to conduct hearings and have hearings and plead for hearings, and how to work in the corridors of Congress, and how to lobby. And a lot of young people are getting into it, and that's the thing that keeps me encouraged.
The greatest commitment in the world doesn't matter unless you've got a cause that has some substance and depth to it. What does wilderness mean? Why is it important to Americans?
I think wilderness is important because it's our roots, it's our beginnings, it's where we all came from. And there's something very powerful and mystical and poignant about it. People who even can't ever go to a big wilderness, I think, like to support the movement because they feel that it should be a part of the American picture. It is should be a great part of the American dream if we still have dreams. I'm very encouraged, tremendously encouraged, by the young people that I'm in touch with, and I'm in touch with a good many of them. That summer biology school in Jackson Hole, they bring the groups over to my house, spend an afternoon. I'm just so touched by those young people, and I think they really want to save something of their heritage. You can even look at it from a selfish man's point of view, too. Wilderness, we don't know what's there still in the wilderness. That may be a very great value to man for medical reasons, scientific reasons, research, you know.
Yeah, I think Bob Allen is working on that right now, trying to find out how many wonderful unknown species there are that might contain a cure for cancer or something like that, and using that as a motivation.
Oh, yes, that wonder drug they developed for the treatment of miliary tuberculosis, you know. I've used that example over and over in talks that I give, because that's an example of something that came from wild country that was untouched, and we don't know how many more things like that there might be.
I'll bet you notice a lot of difference between the kind of attitudes that those young people have who come to your home in Moose and the kinds of young people you met working in conservation issues in the 20s and 30s. How do you measure that difference? What's changed?
I think in the 20s and 30s, the young people who were going out on maybe backpacking trips or canoeing or whatever were just doing it because it was something they enjoyed doing, the experience itself. And maybe they were touched by the feeling that they were in wilderness. But at that time, I don't think they realized that perhaps this was a thing that might be transient or ephemeral and might be taken away from them, might be destroyed. They had no idea about the forces that might be working against the preservation of wilderness. Nowadays, the young people that go into the wilderness are cognizant of all these things. And they realize that here they're enjoying perhaps a pristine atmosphere that may not always be that way unless they do something about it. I was talking to one of these young groups one day, and one of the young boys said to me when he was saying goodbye, "Well, I'm sure glad there's some people like you taking care of these things." And I said, "No, wait a minute. I'm not going to be here forever, and you are going to do it." And those few, you know, it seems like a few. Maybe we've had 1,000 or 2,000 of these young people through this one particular program that I'm familiar with. But they are going to be responsible citizens, I'm sure, wherever they grow up. And they may be the ones who will take the lead and do something.
One thing that pops into my mind are those long lines of young people who aren't involved in wilderness, but are doing things like computer games and spending their lives relating to machines rather than to organic processes. And I worry about those folks. And most of our people are urban people, and they live and die and are buried, and they never touch the earth or know anything about wilderness. We've got a bad imbalance, haven't we?
Yes, indeed, and I think that's why the Wilderness Society, for instance, from almost the beginning, has been interested in urban parks as well as wilderness areas. And I think we need more and more of that. We need open space, breathing space, and places where they can maybe do some active things like canoeing or hiking or something that brings those people out. I realize that as I said the other day here, I know that I'm seeing what you might call, from a conservation's point of view, the cream of the crop. The young people who come out to these summer science schools are already a hand-picked group.
The converted.
Yeah, except that we have some very nice scholarship funds at Teton Science School, and every summer we have a multiracial, and we have, for instance, we had 3 black students from Watts. We've had some from Watts every summer. They already have to show some interest in biology before they can come to the school. But the fact remains that they come from these urban areas, and they may be able to make a difference when they go back, when they get a little older. It seems too much to hope for, but what else can you do but hope?
Well, we're moving into a time of economic and political crisis, maybe nuclear crisis. Good knows, we've got plenty on the scene. And when there's a time of crisis, wilderness doesn't seem to stay high on our list of values. We were able to cut trees in Olympic Park during World War II, and we've got a long history of exploiting wilderness areas when we find it convenient. How does that future look to you?
Well, that future looks very bad, except that also in the next breath I think about the organizations who are watchdogging these things. It just means that those are going to have to be more active, more alert, and more vociferous, I suppose. We have to try to reach out as far as possible to let the public know what's going on. And the other encouraging thing to me is that I find in the little experience I have is that once people learn about these things, they respond, a great many of them. You get a really remarkable response for some one area that's threatened or one issue that comes up. And there again, that's the only hope I see for that aspect of things. People have to be more alert.
I think it was Wendell Berry who said that major public changes begin in people's private lives, and that you start inside and you change a culture from the inside out. How about a housewife or a businessman? What kind of suggestions would you have for a person who hasn't any contact with wilderness to get involved in the kind of work you're talking about? Where can you begin on a practical level?
There are organizations like the Sierra Club and the Audubon Society have chapters, you know, in a great many places. The Wilderness Society doesn't, but we have field representatives. Any housewife who has a glimmering of an interest in these things can certainly find some organization nearby that she can join and learn through. For instance, in Jackson Hole, we have our own little conservation group called the Jackson Hole Alliance, which is watching the growth there, trying to keep support the county master plan, and they're concerned about what's happening to the nearby wilderness. We're all plastered with oil and gas leases in that beautiful, beautiful valley, you know. And it's, you know, I was on the long distance phone this morning talking about one of those places. anybody can get interested and anybody can find some organization to belong to.
I guess I have a little problem with organizations. I think of your describing how you became attached to wilderness through growing up in Alaska and through your early experiences hiking with Olas, and that's the way I got there too, not through an organization. And I get a little depressed when I meet somebody who is a lobbyist for wilderness, who lives in an apartment house 14 stories up in Washington, D.C., and spends most of his or her life that way, don't you?
Yes, I do, and I think that's why it is such a good idea that, for instance, last fall, the top 8 staff members of the Wilderness Society came to a little dude ranch in Jackson Hole just for a retreat for 4 or 5 days. We have to have those lobbyists in Washington, D.C., but they also need to have touch with what it is they're lobbying about. Yeah. Actually, I think it's the hope that I see for the future is from individual people getting concerned, no matter what makes them get concerned, but we just hope that they're in touch with something that alerts them. And we do have to have these organizations being watchdogs and lobbying. But they need the input from the field, from the individuals. And I feel that in nearly, you know, all the questions that face this country today, it's the only change I can see is going to come from the people themselves. Each person needs to feel that he has more power. He can have some power if he so chooses. And I'm always telling people come and say, I don't like, you know, what's going on with something, and I say, write to your senator, write to your congressman. Well, they don't pay any attention. I said, yes, they do. Some secretary is counting how many letters he gets pro and how many letters he gets con every day, at least he gets. So I don't think you need to feel that there's nothing you can do.
I guess that assumes that you see the best road for wilderness preservation through conventional politics. You don't see the wilderness movement as a revolutionary movement.
No, unless it is on the part of some of these young people who are getting more and more interested in it right now. And how they may handle it, I don't know. But I know they do put on demonstrations and marches and things like that. If that's what you call a revolutionary movement, I don't.
Well, I guess part of what's implied in that question is, does our culture, does our political situation, do our social relationships have to change before we can find significant room for wilderness in our lives?
Yeah, that may be. Maybe all these other things come first in most people's lives, and wilderness is something that's way off there in the hinterland somewhere. I don't know, but I feel that more people proportionately are getting interested in saving wild country and even small pieces of wild country. It's all very important. Open space anywhere. We just need space.
Dave Brower, you know, is always threatening to write a book about something. And he writes quite a few of them, but one that he's had in mind for a long time is a book called The Wilderness Within Us, where he's talking about the wild rivers that run through the human body and the amazing things that go to make up an eye and a digestive system, and the wilderness that's right within reach, even in our backyards, in our bodies, all around us, looking at the wood that our rooms are built of. It came from some forest someplace. There are ways even a very civilized person, just looking at his own body or his own surroundings, can connect himself with wild processes, aren't there?
Oh, yes, and the person who's, well, suppose the person confined to a wheelchair, for instance, but he has a little backyard, he's able to maybe get down and do something about planting some flowers or some vegetables or some. I was reading about something about that the other day. It was just a little backyard, but it was so planned that it was like a little park, a little wilderness, and had things happening in it, and it was a sustenance for this person.
We've talked about some of the successes of the wilderness movement. There have been quite a few on the other side. There have been quite a few failures, too. And you must have had to make some assessments along the line as to whether all the failures were worth the rather few successes. But I hear you sounding like a pretty optimistic person. Sounds as if you've made that decision in a positive way.
Well, as you know, Joy, I've given a good many talks, and I think in many of the talks I've said that I'm a natural-born optimist, but maybe I'm an optimist because I'm a coward. Maybe I don't want to face the facts. My older son is always saying to me, Mommy, face the facts. But the facts as they appear to me, I think it's, and what I say to all these young people, it's more fun to be working towards something positive than just standing in the corner with your face to the wall. And I feel optimistic. I feel optimistic because of the things that I have seen and heard and felt from these young people and older people too, who are organizing in my own community to try to keep open space, to try to keep some kind of a livable planet. I had a group of these young people at my house this past winter, and after they went back, they came from a private school in Missouri, a whole group that came out and spent a week at this school, and they came over to my house one day. They sent me a beautiful folder, a big card with a sketch one of them had done on the front, and each child had written a little paragraph to me all over this big page. And it was just really overwhelming, the things they apparently had felt enough from whatever they'd seen there in my house, all this is paintings and the Eskimo ivory collection and the things that I... But mostly what they remarked about was what I said about wilderness. That seemed to be the thing that had been, as they said, an inspiration. Well, of course, that's a great inspiration to me. And I feel there's... Olus used to say that we live by minorities. Anyway, there's a minority on this side, there's a minority on that side, there's a great lump of unleavened dough in the middle, which is the rest of the population who either don't know or don't care or can't do anything about it. But he felt, and I feel, that the leaven is working in that dough some too, and that maybe there's going, if we don't blow the whole planet to pieces in the meantime, I think there's going to be a great wave, a forceful movement toward better living space for people, and therefore better people, happier people, maybe not so much crime in the country.
But if it doesn't work out that way, if we lose most of our wilderness, if we get around to the paving of America and the high-tech civilization that a lot of people believe in, what have we lost, really? What have we lost?
Well, from my point of view, we've lost everything. We've lost all the positive things, all the beautiful things. I doubt if a composer could compose beautiful music if he didn't sometimes have some happy landscape to look at. I think that the loss of space and a wilderness would affect every other aspect of human life. And so we'd be losing everything that anybody could be happy about. It'd be a very unhappy world, I think.
Including some of the deepest levels of our own souls, I suppose.
Yes, because it's within the individual person what happens. That's, I think so. And a very few people can do a great deal, too, on the positive side.
Both you and I met in Alaska. You and Olas and I were out on a wonderful picnic one day.
Yes.
And Olas had a camera over his shoulder, and we were chasing doll sheep, and we had a picnic at Eielson, and
right.
It was a great, great time in my life. So many of the values that are important to me about wilderness have come from some of the same kinds of experiences that you grew up with as well. I guess Alaska has a special role in the American consciousness of wilderness, doesn't it?
Oh yes, I think Alaska is an immeasurable treasure. It ought to have very, very special consideration. It's similar to Jackson Hole, where I live most of the time. A very unique, special place. And Alaska has that 70 times over. It's hard for me to believe that people anywhere, any person who ever traveled in Alaska once could feel otherwise than that was the last great untouched part of what the United States is all about. And I just hope that we'll be able to keep it that way. I think the D2 lands Bill was one of the greatest things that ever happened in our whole history, and I hope we can hang on to all the aspects of it.
Not everybody knows what D2 is about.
Well, D2 happened to be the name of the paragraph in the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act passed by Congress, which stipulated that certain number of millions of acres should be set aside in the national interest, so they're called the national interest lands. And now, of course, they are national parks, wildlife refuges, wild and scenic rivers. And that's, I think it's a great step forward for all the whole American people that could have come about. In the testimony I gave on one of the field hearings on the bill, which was held in Denver, I happened to end my testimony saying, let's save this last treasure. And the other day I had a call from Anchorage, from the Natural History Association up there, who's putting out a book on the national parks of Alaska. And they're calling it Alaska Parklands, This Last Treasure. And they were writing to say they were quoting from my testimony and thanking me. Well, that pleased me, because I think that it is a great, great treasure. And I think it deserves the greatest attention from government, from every agency. I just hope that there'll be some wise management practices up there. It's going to be difficult.
There's one other topic that comes to mind that might seem to you a little bit off to the side, but I recall that you were the first woman graduate of the University of Alaska. And you've been a very influential woman in the conservation movement and in the Wilderness Society and in public consciousness. Do you think women have a special role or a different role than men in public education concerning wilderness? Is there an aspect of a woman's life that puts her in a better position to relate to wilderness than most men can?
I've never thought about it in exactly that way, because I don't believe in separating the sexes very much, I guess. I think people are people. And everybody should be free to be themselves. But perhaps women, from a sort of a sense of balance that they use normally in just housekeeping, that sense of balance of the various factors that go to make up life, maybe they feel that wilderness is a part of our American life that should be part of the balance. That's good housekeeping to have towns, to have cities, but also to have some wilderness. I don't know what else it might be in a woman's life that would make her feel, but I know the women who are in this wilderness movement do feel very keenly about it.
I'm just wondering if it's really just a coincidence that we have a growing women's movement at the same time we have a growing environmental movement, if maybe the two aren't connected in maybe some deeper ways than that.
Yes, I think it's the modern woman has a sense of the fitness of things, perhaps. And that's what she's striving for. And I know some of the young women who have been very active in the so-called women's movement. Some of the things I haven't been too sympathetic about, because, as I said, I don't believe in judging things merely on a sex basis. I think that everybody should be given the right to be themselves anyway. But there is a connection between the, I think, because between the women's movement and the wilderness movement, just a balance, good housekeeping.